The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Merrick Avenue and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is Long Island's WGBB Sports Talk New York. I'm your host, Mike Guidone, joined as always by my co-host, the man we call Cappy, Chris Caputo. 516-623-1240 is our number, as always, 516-623-1240. Before we get started tonight, just want to welcome in Cap. Welcome, and how's everything going?
Everything's great. Right. Memorial Day weekend doesn't feel like it, but
that's right.
Nice to get there as we get closer to June. Lots of sports going on, and good to be back in the studio with you. A little late night again.
That's it, but we're very excited right off the bat tonight. We're going to be speaking with Scott Kiner, who just penned a book about his famous father, Ralph Kiner, who was a New York Met legend broadcaster. Also, Ralph himself, Hall of Fame player for the Pirates and amongst other teams. And right now, we're very happy to welcome in Mr. Scott Kiner. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, you guys. I appreciate being here tonight. And I want to point out that my father served in World War II as a naval aviator.
Yes, sir.
And spent over 1,200 hours flying in the war, and we're honoring him as well this weekend. So
absolutely. You know, that's something I think, unfortunately, that you know, many of the younger generation right now, they don't realize that so many key ball players, such as your father, you know, during that time spent not only just time in the war, but really saw action and had major roles at that time.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. I mean, Ted Williams comes to mind because not only did he serve in World War II, but he also served during the Korean War. But
yes.
Yeah, Bob Feller, so many other great players were part of that, stopped playing baseball and served their country. And this is what we celebrate this weekend.
So again, we have Scott Kiner here, the son of Ralph Kiner, Hall of Famer, inducted into the MLB Hall of Fame in 1975. And also his mother, Nancy Chafee, is that how I pronounce it, Scott?
That's correct, yes.
Was a famous tennis player at the time and got her way up to number 4, I believe, in the rankings at one point. But at some point, Scott, you decided, you know, and you had a career of yourself trying to do some broadcasting, you decided to sit down and write a book called One of a Kiner. Can you talk a little bit about where that came from and, you know, what led you to that?
Well, I would say that maybe because my father passed away, and so did my mother several years ago. And when they were dating and going together, and when they got married in the 1951, it really was the marriage of two incredible people. My mother was the glamour girl at tennis at the time. My father was probably the most eligible bachelor in the United States. And when they got married in 1951, it was a real big event. And I just felt that it needed to be documented. And the other thing is that from my perspective and the perspective of the book, One of a Kiner, you get a behind-the-scenes look at their relationship and also their lives together and the family that they created. It has a lot of twists and turns, and I just felt it was time to tell that story.
So, Scott, I wanted to ask you, you know, you wrote this book, but, you know, as a young kid, at what point did you really realize that you, you know, were the product of two amazing athletes, two very popular people within, you know, America? Did you realize that you had famous parents when you were a young kid?
I really didn't, but initially, when I was born, my father was in the last year of his baseball career, which was an incredible career with the Cleveland Indians. That was the one year he played for the Indians. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of his career he spent with the Pittsburgh Pirates. But he had retired. He retired and actually became general manager of the San Diego Padres, who were at that time in the Pacific Coast League. So that was no big deal. But once he left the Padres, he wound up becoming the voice of the Chicago White Sox. So when my mom packed us up, my brother, my sister, and myself, and put us in a car, and we drove cross-country from Southern California to Chicago, and he was the voice of the Chicago White Sox. At that point, I figured, this is kind of strange. I get to be on the field and nobody else does. You know, it was very, very strange. And then the next year, of course, he became the voice of the New York Mets with Lindsey Nelson and Bob Murphy. And that was even more bizarre. But it was about the time that he got in his broadcasting career that I realized that I'm not like everybody else. So that's why, you know, I wrote the book, One of a Kinder, to kind of tell that story.
So, Scott, you know, we're going to get into a lot of the Mets stuff, but a little bit beforehand, can you just talk a little bit about, you know, at that time when he's starting to go from, you know, player, general manager to being an announcer. At that point, he was trying to get down to wherever the team it was, the White Sox, the Mets, get down to spring training, and you probably wouldn't see him again full time until October-ish. Could you talk about what it was like kind of being wherever that home was for you and being with your mom and maybe not seeing your dad as much growing up?
Yeah, I was my brother, my sister, myself. My mother did a yeoman's job of, you know, filling in for my father, because in his book that he wrote, Baseball Forever, my 60 years in baseball, by the time he passed away, that was more like 75 years. Yeah. He would leave in late February and go to spring training. And then we were at home going to school, and my mom would raise us kids. And then we all get in the car when the school year ended and drive cross country and get to New York. And even when we were there during the baseball season, he was on the road half the time. So, you know, I guess I would say that there's the good and the bad of it is that some people might say, you know, I can tell you my dad never saw me play a Little League game, but you take the good with the bad. I mean, he was a wonderful father, a tremendous role model. When you consider the fact that my father, he was born an only child, and his mother was an orphan. So what we know about his mother is that she was raised in Oregon and served in World War One as a nurse. Wound up in New Mexico, in southern New Mexico, where she met my grandfather, my father's father. They had one child, my father. My dad's dad died in an accident when he was 4 years of age. So my dad grew up with a single mom and no aunts, uncles, or cousins and nephews. And to go from nothing, virtually nothing, to becoming one of the greatest ambassadors for the sport of baseball is an amazing thing. So I'm not complaining about him missing my Little League game. He can do what he wants to. He was just an amazing success story, American success story. And the people who live in New York, you know, who grew up with him for 50 years behind the mic, I know that he's venerated in New York. He's one of a kinder, I should say.
Absolutely. We can definitely vouch for that because, you know, both of us grew up Mets fans. I'm in my 50s. Chris is in his 40s. So many a night I went to sleep listening to your dad calling Mets games. And just he was a major, major part of my childhood and a big part of it. I want to just double back, Scott, if we can, here for a second, you know, about your dad as the player. You know, after your dad passed away, one of the great baseball writers, Marty Noble, he said that your dad was one of baseball's genuine and most charming gentlemen, which it certainly seemed like that when he would call games. However, there's some stories that your dad wasn't really treated all that well by the baseball writers of America when it came during his playing days for voting for MVP. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, in writing the book, it took me a year to write the book. I did extensive research on it. And you know, my dad, in his 10-year career, his first 7 years, he led the major leagues in home runs. Actually, the National League in home runs. His first 6 years, Hank Greenberg led the American League his first in my dad's rookie season. Mm-hmm. My dad led the National League in his rookie season.
Gotcha.
After his second year, it meant a lot to him. He led both leagues in home runs for 6 years in a row, which broke Babe Ruth's record, and that meant a lot to him that he has that record. And that record will probably, in our lifetimes, is not likely to be broken. It has been broken in 75 years,
right?
So I don't think it's going to be broken anytime soon. So, but during that time period, that from 1947 when he hit 51 home runs, 49 he hit 54 home runs, In 40, and go, let's go back to 47. In 47, he had the highest WAR in the National League. He had he led the league in home runs. He led the league in RBIs. He led the league in total bases, and he led the league in OPS, on base plus slugging percentage. And he did not get one vote for first place in the MVP voting.
That's unbelievable.
That year, it is unbelievable. And the guy who won it, Bob Elliott, who was a third baseman for the Boston Braves, he had a good year and he was a good glove. But you can't do that. And in today's world, that would never have happened. No. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he played in Pittsburgh instead of an East Coast town like New York. Mm-hmm. And in 47, the Pirates, they had they did not have a winning season. But the Most Valuable Player Award, if you look at the criteria for it, it's not where your team finished. It's what was your value to that team.
Right.
And in my dad's case, he was, in many instances, the only thing of value to the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he just dominated the league. And during, from 1947 to about 1951, when he was in the peak of his career, in those years, he only received one first place vote for MVP in those years. Only one. And it's like, that would not happen today.
No.
But that was the way it was, and that back then, there was no television, and he played in an era where he just didn't, in my opinion, I don't believe that he really got his fair due, but he would never complain about it. He was so happy to be making a living, mm-hmm, doing what he loved, that he would never have complained about it.
Again, we're talking with Scott Kiner, the son of Ralph Kiner. As he mentioned, played 10 seasons, retired at the age of 32 with back problems, helped serve in the war, 369 homers, 7 straight NL home run titles. But when you're playing in Pittsburgh and, you know, people are trying to get you out of there and lowballing you money-wise, the MVP votes were not there. But he is a Hall of Famer, and I think that probably has to mean a lot to you to see his plaque in the Hall of Fame and, you know, to kind of live on in that way, right, Scott?
There's no question about it. That was actually the most important thing to him, was to be a member of the Hall of Fame. He said having that HOF after your name is just like being a doctor and having a doctorate or having PhD after your name. It meant so much to him. And he went through agony just to get in there because he got elected on his final year of eligibility by one or two votes. And but he got in. I think part of the reason why he didn't get in sooner was because he only played 10 years, and 10 years is the requirement. 10 years is the minimum requirement to be in the Hall of Fame. And he played 10 years, and I think a lot of the baseball writers felt that even though he had the most stellar 10 years that anybody could have possibly had, and he would fill ballparks, the turnstiles were turning, people came out in droves. And as a matter of fact, in like 1950, the Pirates, a small market, drew over 1,500,000 fans. They drew more fans then than they will this year because of my father. But still, it doesn't really matter because he's in, and that was the thing that meant the most to him.
Can you just expand on some of his friends? I know people that he grew up with. In the book, One of a Kinder, you talk about Hank Greenberg and some of the other people. Can you talk a little bit about how he became friends with a lot of these baseball players?
Well, he was, again, I'll repeat myself, he felt so blessed to be able to make a living playing baseball. It really didn't matter if he was making, in his first year, he made $5,000. Second year, I think he made $10,000. Third year, they gave him a 2-year contract for $35,000, and he was like over the moon about that. But the guy who really was my father's mentor was Hank Greenberg. In 1947, the owner of the Pirates, John Galbraith, swung a deal. What happened was Greenberg, who had played his entire career with the Detroit Tigers and had 2 World Series rings on his fingers because of the time he spent there, was 2-time MVP, was a shoe-in for the Hall of Fame. The Tigers decided they weren't going to pick up his option, And he said, well, you're not going to take my option. I'm going to retire. And the Detroit Tigers put him out to waivers, not in the American League, but in the National League. And John Galbraith approached Hank and said, we would like to hire you. And he said, no, I'm going to retire. And Galbraith went to New York and had lunch with Hank and met every demand that Hank required, which was, he said he wanted $100,000 a year, which was a record sum at the time, and said he wanted the fences pulled in Forbes Field because the fences were ridiculous in Forbes Field. I mean, in Briggs Stadium, where he had played in Detroit, it was 340 down the left field line. And in Pittsburgh, it was like 360, so they put in a bullpen out in left field and shortened it to 330, I believe, or 335, and gave him the $100,000 and said, I'll play one more year. Well, the first thing that Hank did in spring training was to pull because my father had led the National League the previous year in home runs, and Hank had led the American League the previous year in home runs, they were asked to have their pitcher taken a lot. And Hank became my father's big brother that he never had, because he never had a brother or a sister. He was an only child. And Hank took him under his wing. And the thing that Hank taught him was, he taught him to crowd the plate. He taught him how to zone a pitch, which means keep your eye on the hand of the pitcher as it comes over the shoulder. And once you see the ball is in a particular zone, that's the ball, that's the pitch you want to hit. And Hank actually set a new Pittsburgh record in 1947 when he hit 25 home runs that season. But my dad, that same season, well, let me back up just a second. My dad got off to a really bad start in 1947.
Right.
And after April and May, he only had 3 home runs, and the team was thinking of sending him back down to the International League. And Hank went to the ownership and said,
Keep him up,
Kiner will hit.
Yep.
And he bet the owner, I'll bet you a suit of clothes, he finishes the year with more than 30 home runs.
Right.
Hank won that bet hands down because Dad hit 51 home runs that year.
Yeah.
He became only the second National Leaguer ever to break the 50 home run mark. Johnny Mize tied him that year. I mean, that's a debate in and of itself, but nevertheless, my dad went from June 1st. On June 1st, he hit 2 home runs. From June 1st until the end of the season, he hit 48 home runs. And Hank was the reason. Hank was his protege. My dad was Hank's protege, and Hank was the mentor that my dad needed to put him over the top. And believe me, they were best friends forever.
Good supporter to have behind you.
Well, he was the best man at my parents' wedding.
Yep.
For a good reason.
So we also wanted to kind of touch on this, and I know it's an important aspect of your dad's career and important part of the book as well, but your dad, you mentioned about making $5,000, $10,000, and he was happy to do it. But I'm sure as his stats improved as years went on, he was looking, as anybody would, to, make a salary befitting of his stature. Can you talk a little bit about how he was kind of instrumental in helping, some younger ball players and players in that time, step out and start to make a little bit more money?
Well, if you really are a student of baseball, it's the pendulum has swung 180 degrees the other direction. But in the day that my father was playing, the players were pretty much indentured slaves.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman from Boston. His name was Murphy, and he was an attorney. And he was trying to unionize the players because he said, and I'm going to quote him here, he said that the baseball players of that day, which was 1946, he said, were among the most exploited and oppressed employees in the nation.
Wow.
And he chose Pittsburgh to be the place where he was going to try to unionize or get the players to organize. I shouldn't say unionize, mm-hmm. organize. And because the reason he chose Pittsburgh was because because the steel mills were unionized and the coal mills were unionized. So Pittsburgh was the most unionized town in the nation at the time, right after World War II. And my dad at the time was a rookie, and he took a back seat. But he became acutely aware of how poorly the players were treated. If you remember back then, and it's hard for people who are great baseball fans today to realize that there was a clause in baseball called the reserve clause. And once you signed with, as my dad did with the Pirates, you yourself had no ability to negotiate with anybody else. If they decided to send you down, you went down. Mm-hmm. They owned you for the most part. And if you recall, baseball still has an immunity to the antitrust laws. So it was at the time basically a monopoly run by a cartel of rich owners. And the only leverage that a player had, and my dad fortunately had this leverage, was if you put people in the stadium and you drew people to the field, to the game, you were an asset that they needed to have. And my father was the greatest asset at that time that Pittsburgh had. So my father had a unique perspective in the sense that because he was so handsome and so good looking and so articulate and so talented behind with a bat in his hand, that the ownership wasn't going to mess with him. But if you were, you know, a Punch and Judy hitter and of little value, if you acted up, they could make it very, very difficult on you. You had no leverage. And to make my point, in those days, a player could not have an agent. Not only could they not have an agent, they couldn't have an attorney.
Really?
And when it came down to negotiating their contract, the player himself had to do it with the general manager, mano y mano.
Wow.
And they had no leverage whatsoever. In my dad's case, he was such a celebrity in his day because of who he was and what he did. He had a direct pipeline to the owner of the team, and he negotiated his contract with the owner because the owner was making a lot of money off of him.
Sure.
So if you didn't have any leverage, and the other thing was there was no insurance, there was no workman's compensation. So let's say you blew out your knee fighting in the second. You were done.
Yeah, that was it.
You had no recourse. You had nothing. And most of the players in my dad's days, once the baseball season was over, they had to find another job in order to make ends meet. But my dad became the representative for the National League players. I think it was in 1950-51. And at that time, the only reason why the owners even allowed representative, and one man, my dad, one man represented the entire National League. Over in the American League, the other representative was Allie Reynolds, the pitcher of the Yankees. And between my dad and Allie Reynolds, they were able to negotiate a deal to create a pension plan for the baseball players who played 10 years. And when they retired, they would at least have something to fall back on. And that was, my dad felt very good about the fact that he was helping his fellow players. And he was actually very involved in forming what is called the Baseball Assistance Team, which is called BAT, which helps former players who have fallen on hard times. So my dad was a very compassionate person because he was at the time in 1952 getting paid $95,000 a year, the highest paid player in the National League. And as one of his teammates said, home run hitters drive Cadillacs, single hitters drive Fords.
That's right. One of a Kiner chronicles the lives and legacies of two sports icons, Nancy and Ralph Kiner. Their son, Scott Kiner, writes the book. Scott, who had his own broadcasting career covering things for CBS and ABC, gives us an insight here into their lives. So for us here in New York, we remember him from 1961 to 2013 behind the microphone. And sometimes you get things like Gary Cooper instead of Carter and even, you know, messing his own. We loved Kiner's Corner. You know, after the game, even John Franco, who was a New Yorker when he was with the Cincinnati Reds, looked forward to being interviewed in a post game by Ralph Kiner for Kiner's Corner. Did Kiner's Corner kind of mean as much to you as it did to everybody else?
Absolutely. When I was a child, I remember most Shea Stadium because the studio under the stands, it was kind of magical. I basically grew up in Shea Stadium, so I kind of ran around that stadium it was like my playground. But when it was time to do the Kiner's Corner, I was typically standing off camera on the side watching the show, and it was always interesting. First of all, everybody on the show was a hero to me. I was a kid, and they were all superstars as far as I was concerned. And it was just a wonderful experience, and I know my dad really enjoyed it. I mean, the show was iconic, and yeah, I think someone once said that the show had the longest running tenure of any show in New York television history. I think it ran for about 30 years. But you got to remember that. I mean, there were so many. I wasn't in the studios at the time he had Choo Choo Coleman on. When Choo Choo, yeah, see, you're laughing. You remember the scene when my dad
he
had
stopped talking
Coleman
to Choo Choo
and Roger Craig on together, and he thought, because Choo Choo had hit a home run in that game, one of the few he hit. And my dad asked Choo Choo, he said, Choo Choo, how did you get your name? And Choo Choo said, I don't know, bub. And then my dad's like, okay.
That was the end of talking to Choo Choo.
Yeah. Then my dad said, well, Choo Choo, what's your wife's name and what's she like? And Choo Choo says, her name's Mrs. Coleman and she likes me, bub. And at that point, he finished the interview with Roger Craig and Kiner's Corner went on.
Yeah.
We're going to play something
for
you. It was
a wonderful thing.
We're going to play something for you. Hopefully it has some good feelings as you listen to Ralph Kiner.
Sure.
Strike two, and again, Tom Gorman is a strike away from ending the ball game. Back in the 13th, he served up a two-run home run that tied the game. And this ball hit out to deep left field. It could be extra bases, could be gone. It is gone. Goodbye. And the ball game is tied. How about that?
Unbelievable. So do you know what that
great.
Is? Do you know
yeah,
what that
I
is?
I know who
Scott?
That is.
Yeah. That was a July 5th marathon with the Braves.
The game that would never end.
Where they did fireworks at 4 o'clock in the morning as opposed to 2 nights ago when the Mets decided to do fireworks at 1 o'clock in the morning. But that's the voice that we remember of gone, goodbye, the home run call from your dad. Is that something?
You know, yeah, I love that. I just love that. But he also once said he got into that call a little too early one time, and he said, it's going to be caught.
Well, everybody's had that from John Sterling all the way through Gary Cohen. They've had situations where, you know, you think the ball's out and then it's not. But a long career doing radio and TV, which is difficult, and I think he did it really well for many years. I do have a question. Hopefully it's not too tough for you. As time went on, we know that Ralph developed Bell's palsy. He decided to stay on the air and kind of eventually just worked part-time. Was that hard for you to see him struggle on the air because that's where he was his place?
You know what? You're absolutely right. I had a difficult time with that because I loved him so much, but I remember walking with him one evening after he had been inflicted with that, and I said, Dad, you're 75 years of age. You really don't need to keep working. Why don't you retire, and we'll just play golf all the time? Mm-hmm. And he said to me, he said, Scott, I can't do that. I love working. I love baseball. And he went back, and the Mets were kind enough to let him work. And that first game of the new season, he did the game with Howie Rose, and they asked Howie afterwards, how did he do? And he said he was as funny as ever. He was his wonderful self. He was fantastic. Well, Howie was kind of covering for him, and the fans knew that he was impaired, But the thing about Bell's palsy is it's not a permanent infliction. He had slurred speech and had difficult speaking. By the middle of the season, you wouldn't have known he even had been inflicted. But my dad he wanted to work. He loved baseball so much. I mean, as I say in the book, baseball to him is like singing to Tony Bennett and making people laugh like George Carlin. I mean, it was his life, and he wasn't going to give it up.
So, Scott, a couple of weeks back, you had a special moment with someone within your family, Major Leaguer Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Was this your first meeting with Isaiah? And, obviously, I know you guys were aware of your connection, but was this your first meeting, and did he, in fact, hit a home run after you guys met?
Yeah, it was an amazing, surreal experience. When I was working on the book, I was reading at the same time that Isaiah, who had said for a few years, Isaiah came up to the major leagues in 2018 with the Texas Rangers, and because his hyphenated last name, which is due to the fact that his parents aren't married and he's Hawaiian, resulted in people asking me, are you related to this person, or are you? But I was reading as I was writing the book again and again and again, where Isaiah was saying that we were related. Mm-hmm. Well, because I was doing all this research on the book, I found out that we definitely are related. My dad's great grandmother, which would be my great great grandmother, is Isaiah's great 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 grandmother. So we go back to Pennsylvania Dutch. And but no one believed him.
Yeah.
And because my father passed in 2014 and Isaiah came up in 2018, my father wasn't alive. But I can tell you what, my dad would be very, very proud of him.
Sure.
And the fact that they're related. And so I kind of realized after researching and writing the book that someone needed to break the ice here. And I actually write in the foreword of the book that I was going to give Isaiah the first book, and it came out on the day that I met him, the book, and I gave him the first book. And I told him, and I told the New York media that, and I explained to the New York media that everything Isaiah has said has been, it wasn't a lie, it's all true. Mm-hmm. We are related. And ironically, or whatever, my wife would say it was divine intervention. He stepped into the plate after that press conference and at his first at bat, and hit quite a home run. It was a line shot over the left center field, exit velocity of 105. And I was sitting watching this, going like, "Dad."
Sure.
And and I told him, don't be a stranger. I'm looking forward to spending. That was the first time I ever met him.
Mm-hmm.
Was in that press conference, which would have been 2 weeks ago tomorrow night.
Yeah.
Was the first time I ever met him. So that was just over the top cool.
I'm actually looking at a picture from the press conference of you guys holding up, your dad's jersey and Isaiah holding up his, and that it just looks like a special moment. So I can only imagine what it was like, actually getting to meet some of your family and then have him go out and do that. That had to be tremendous.
It really was special, and I've since been in touch with his mother, who's over in Hawaii, and we're hoping to get together at some future date.
Nice.
I'm hoping it's in Hawaii.
No, I don't blame you.
Once again, we're finishing up with Scott Kiner, who wrote the book One of a Kiner. Scott, Ralph was involved with the Mets from the 60s on, and obviously with you being around. Can you just share with us maybe one memory of either being at Shea Stadium or being a part of watching the Mets throughout your time? What might stick out in your mind?
Well, the Mets were such an important part of my life. I remember Banner Day My mother gave us magic markers and a white bed sheet. My brother and I went upstairs to create our banner, and of course we went with the motto of the Mets, "Let's go Mets," and did our best job. And when we lifted up the sheet, right there in the carpet that had bled through the sheet was "Let's go Mets." And there was one time when I was waiting for my dad to finish, because after he did Kiner's Corner, he'd go up to the press box, and which was a place where the media got together after they had posted their stories, which was kind of a tradition, and he would be up there for about 20, 30 minutes. And I went out and ran on the bases. The ballpark was empty, and I realized that I'd spent too much time down there. I needed to go up and see my dad so we can go home, and I found myself locked into Shea Stadium. I'm probably the only kid locked into Shea Stadium, and I couldn't. I went to the bullpen door, which the players go out of. It was locked. I couldn't get to the elevator to go up to the press level. I was locked. And I went out to the bullpen again, and I saw my dad out there in the station wagon, and he was looking all over for me. So I just, you know, when you're 12 years old, you're a spider, so you can scale those fences pretty easily. And I scaled the fence and got out of there. But geez, he wasn't very happy with me. But I think I have the record for being the only person locked into Shea Stadium.
So, the name of the book, One of a Kinder. And, Scott, if you can tell us, I'm assuming the book is available on Amazon. Any other platform? Any other platforms that we can promote for you? Because this is a must read. Number one for any baseball fan, but especially for any Mets fan who grew up with Ralph Kiner as the voice of the Mets.
Absolutely, Amazon is the easiest way. You can get it through the Baseball Hall of Fame. They have it in their store. But for the most, 90% of all books today are sold on Amazon. So
I miss bookstores.
Go on Amazon, type in One of a Kinder, and I'll also add that I think that it would be a great Father's Day present for any dad who is a Mets fan or a Ralph Kiner fan or a Pittsburgh Pirates fan.
Yeah, anybody that likes tennis or baseball. There is a lot of tennis in there. So, I was surprised to read a lot about that, talking about Wimbledon, U.S. championships, making it to, I believe, the semifinals or the finals of the doubles U.S. championships in 1951. Am I right on that one?
Actually, my mom was the first unseeded player to make it to the semifinals. Back then, it was at Forest Hills. Very quickly, I want to tell you a quick story. My dad and my mom were dating in 1951, and my mom flew to New York to make a connection to go to Wimbledon. Well, my dad knew that she was going to do that, so he set up a dinner in New York because the Pirates were playing the Dodgers in Brooklyn, and he was going to propose to my mother at dinner that night. My mother gets into the cab from her hotel to go to dinner, and the cabbie has the radio on Walter Winchell. And Walter Winchell says on his show, and my mother's in the cab, says, "Here's a news flash. Ralph Kiner and Nancy Chafee are engaged to be married." And she hasn't even gotten to the restaurant.
Yeah, he's got no choice at that point.
He's going to propose before she got to dinner.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
But she didn't say anything.
Yeah.
My dad said, he found out later, and he said, "I know why you didn't say anything. You wanted to make sure you got the ring."
That's right. Well, we appreciate you coming on, Scott, and hopefully there's plenty more in this book that people that want to buy the book, One of a Kiner, you can buy it on Amazon. We're talking with Scott Kiner tonight, the son of Ralph Kiner. So we appreciate your time tonight, and great book and great stories tonight.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's a pleasure to be on WGBB.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And for us, just one last thing, everything you ever read or hear about your dad was just what a class act he was. You could tell, coming through the radio, just what a sweet guy. You obviously followed in those footsteps. We appreciate, as Chris said, all your stories. Wish you great success on the book. And I appreciate the idea as a Father's Day gift, because if my wife's listening, that's definitely one to pick up. So we wish you all the best. Good luck with the book. And we'd love to have you on again, like Chris said, for some more stories in the future.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Scott Kiner, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with the last quarter here on WGBB.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Talk New York. Mike Wadone along with Chris Cap Caputo, as always. 516-623-1240 is our number. 516-623-1240 if you'd like to call in. Talk about a little bit of Ralph Kiner, Scott Kiner, his son, and the book, Son of... which really, you know, as Cap, I just wanted to say this. I didn't get a chance, you know, as Ralph Kiner's son. I'm younger than you, way before there was cable TV.
Mm-hmm.
Kiner's Corner was where you got to see interviews. It was like you didn't want the game to go extra innings because there was no Kiner's Corner. It was like, oh,
yeah.
You know, seeing guys like Pete Rose and, you know, just Willie Stargell. I was a Pirates guy back then. And he loved to have the Pirates on. Just a great book, I'm sure, and we appreciate having him on. But two stories tonight. One, you know, the Mets themselves, who we'll get to. They're in the ninth right now, trying to close out and take this series from the Dodgers. But the New York Knicks, and if you're watching the game, if you're following along right now, they're down 16 mid-third quarter. Just a killer, tough spot to be in. You know, and Cap, you know, as you mentioned to me before we came back from the break, you'd be foolish to think this all doesn't stem from game one.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you look back at the Celtics series, and it's almost like the USA beating Russia and still needing to win one more game in the Olympics in 1980. Did a lot of that take something away from what was going on? New York erupted. 7th Street was shut down. And I think people thought of that as the championship way before. Now, was it good that the Knicks got past the first round for the first time in 3 years, make it to the Eastern Conference Finals for the first time in 25, 26 years? Yeah, I think that's good. But, Mike, you and I had this conversation. That's not what the Knicks were built for.
No.
They went out and made these trades to try and make an NBA Finals. From there, yes, everything is kind of gravy. But they had a huge lead. We could talk to 14, 16 points with 3 minutes to go. And six threes in a row. And Mike, I know you're not a foul guy, but I would have fouled.
Yeah, I'm becoming one.
I would have fouled after 3 3-pointers.
Yes, yes.
Just to slow them down.
Absolutely.
And stop the game and put them at, like, they were not getting around screens. They weren't putting the effort in. They weren't going after loose balls. I thought they went to the basket too fast. Brunson was, you know, had like 7 turnovers. Could have pulled the ball out. And the other big point in game one, Mike, was they went on a huge run with Brunson on the bench.
Yes.
And they brought him back almost like that ceremonial, let's have him on the court for the win. I didn't think they needed to. I think they jumped the gun. And I thought they also needed to go a little bit more with Mitchell Robinson. But, man, that was a killer, Mike.
Yes.
That game, to lose that one, changed the whole series. Now, if they would have won tonight, or if they do come back somehow and win that game tonight, it's like, okay, well, home court doesn't matter that much. But if you go down 3-0 after dropping two really rough games at home, I'm sorry to talk a lot about that subject, but Tibbs got outcoached in that game.
And a surprise, well, not really a surprise move. Well, I guess because it was kind of reported beforehand that there were going to be some lineup changes, but they went big to start the game
with
Mitch Robinson.
Pulled hard because they wanted to, the starters were like a minus 50.
Yeah.
And that's a tough thing. You know, you can't start the game out slow every single time.
But I'm looking at the stats right now as it's live. There's 6 minutes to go, third quarter. Karl Anthony Towns, 4 points. Now he's got 7 boards. 4 points. I mean,
he had been playing really well.
He had been, but it just seems, I don't know if he's, you know, and again, we always go to these things. Is he hurt? Is there something up? You know, who, there were all these things, who won the trade if they both make the finals? I mean, two different players, of course. I mean, Julius Randle is like a bulldog, but last year people wanted to run him out of town during the playoffs. They were ripping his poster down in Penn Station. You know, Towns, if he can shoot, that's fine. He can't defend a chair, the guy, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and Brunson's no better defensively. No. Mike, how many times have you seen a person, I know in high school it's hard, get 5 fouls in one quarter?
Oh, it's unbelievable.
That's bad.
Yeah, I know. Well, you think last year, too, they had Hartenstein, right? Isaiah Hartenstein, who was, you know, not a talented offensive player, but could rebound the heck out of the ball, could defend, you know, a lot of presence out there, a lot of juice. You lost him. Tough thing to do. The team still does well this year, but I think in those gritty bulldog times, that's the type of player you're looking back and you're going, man, we miss that guy.
Yeah, and he just went for the money. They couldn't afford him anymore.
It was impossible.
And people are already talking about, well, if you trade this starter and this starter and this bench pick and a 2030 first round pick, you can go get Giannis. I don't see blowing this thing up as the answer, but I just think that, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the answer is getting a new coach or making some.
I don't think so, but I'll tell you something that infuriated me today. I read Isaiah Thomas making comments about how Tibbs is costing the Knicks this series. And I
miss those, Mike. Like the Isaiah Thomas who used to work for the Knicks and was brought up on charges of having bad relations with women?
Yeah, Isaiah.
Okay.
Isaiah
with the pill in the lane?
Could you please just go away, okay, and stop? Don't ever comment on anything Knicks related.
No.
All right, you were a joke as a coach.
It's like
you were a joke
Jackson
as an
out.
Executive. Yeah. You were a fantastic player. I loved you as a player. You know, but please, I don't know why they keep bringing this guy back to comment on anything because he's got zero credibility.
Yeah,
agreed. Zero. So, you know, I'll listen to other guys. I mean, should this cost Tibbs his job? He brought him to the Eastern Conference Finals. I'm sorry. It should not cost him his job.
I know.
I can't. You know, you want to, if they flame out here, go 4 out. Yeah, it's terrible. It's not a great thing. There's things he's going to learn from. He's got to come back next year.
If you're listening at home, 516-623-1240. We'll take your calls on anything sports-related. We're talking a little bit about the Knicks right now. WGBB also has a webcast. You can listen there. If you're in the car listening, that's great as well. We appreciate any phone calls to talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. But, Mike, you're bringing up a good point there as you have kind of that. Do you have that rotating door? Does that help? And I don't think it does. It's just that. This team, I think, was built for this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, a couple of guys I feel like haven't given them extra. Now, I think that Tibbs needs to use his bench more. I felt like McBride played some good minutes, and that's why Robinson started, I think, this game. But you just can't lose that first game. It was just one of those games where I'm sitting there watching it, Mike, and it's, okay, a three. All right, another one. And now I'm going, whoa, wait, they can't handle the pressure. There's another one, a turnover. And then it's like 30-some-odd seconds to go with the ball up by three, and they're going to the basket. I'm like, pull it out. Bring that clock down to 10.
Yeah.
You know, and as I said to you during the break, there were situations earlier in the game where the Pacers wanted their coach to challenge, and he did not. And then later in the game, there was a non-foul called on one of the Knicks, and they couldn't challenge. And they lose that one. And then the next thing, the ball goes out of bounds, and they had a challenge, and they were able to get the ball back in overtime. Think about this, Mike. You know how teams score, and then maybe they're a little bit deflated? Because some people say going into overtime, the momentum usually favors the team that just made the comeback.
Right.
The Knicks had the lead.
Yeah.
They were up at least 4 at some point in overtime. And then they let it fade. And I think that Rick Carlisle is a very underrated coach. He won the 2011 championship for Dallas, and now he's come there in 3 or 4 years and done some great things with Indiana. I really don't think he has the personnel to win a championship, but he's doing a great job with his players. Not that I like the Pacers, but I like the way that they're playing.
Yeah, they got off to a very rough start this year. I think there were seven games under 500 early in the season, and they caught fire. They buy into him, obviously. He has the right system. He's been around forever, so he does have the chops, and he makes great decisions and with his personnel. I mean, he does go deeper. The team, obviously.
They are deeper.
Yeah, they are deeper for sure. I'm looking at stats here from tonight, which Knicks down 15 now.
Well, Mike, they have 59 points late in the third.
Yeah.
Did you see the other night Minnesota had over 100 before the fourth quarter started. They put up 143 points. So,
well, I think this
got to score.
This is probably going to tell the tale right here. So, OG Anunoby has 16 points, 4 for 6 from 3.
Better than the other night.
Okay. Cat, 0 for 3 from 3. Miles Bridges, 1 for 6.
Oh, gosh.
Jalen Brunson, 1 for 5. Hart, 0 for 2. Landry Shamet, 1 for 2. Deuce McBride, not a point. I mean, anybody could look at this right now, even if you're not a basketball fan, and just say this has got to be an ugly offensive performance.
Yeah, I was about to take off the Kodai Senga and jersey and wear the Villanova, but I'll stay away. I think what they're doing with those Villanova guys is good. It's just that these guys haven't done it in the playoffs down the stretch, and this is tough. And I think putting Robinson in the starting lineup, I think was good to try to get a shakeup, but also I think it sent the wrong message.
I was going to say, does that reek of desperation kind of?
Yeah, especially when you got a guy like Hart who will do anything for you, and Robinson is known as, hey, I'll get an alley-oop and I'll slam it down and if they foul me, I'm not going to be able to make the foul shot. So I don't know about that move, but it's going to be hard to come back if you go down 3-0. But switching gears there, Mike.
Yeah.
Reed Garrett comes in and gets the save.
Let's go.
For the Mets. 3-1 win. Really should have won the game Friday night. Should have swept the Dodgers. Had that game probably at least three times in extra innings. I could not sleep. Up all night after the Knicks had lost game two.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, this is going to be a really bad weekend. To come back and win the next two, and now to play the White Sox and then the Rockies and the Dodgers again. You know, the Mets could be kind of getting back on track. Now, they only scored 3 runs, and the Mets have scored, I believe, under 5 runs in like 7 out of their last 8 games. But getting wins against this team, that's taking a step up.
I think one of the storylines that was a little bit lost here with the Mets over this last two weeks or so, tonight, you know, Pete Alonso, he goes deep.
First time in like 17 games.
That was the longest stretch of his career.
Correct.
Without a home run.
Yeah, 60-something at bats.
And all the what's all the hoopla on, of course, Juan Soto. So, Pete had gotten off to that great start. His stats are still good. But, yeah, he was struggling big time.
Did you see the play right before the home run?
Yes.
Juan Soto hits a somewhat weak ground ball. I didn't think he tore it coming out of the box, but he ran hard enough to beat out the play.
Right.
I think at that point people are like, okay, good. At least he's running a little bit. And then to see Pete hit the home run, I think that puts some good stuff out there. But the first batter of the game, Ohtani, hits one into the upper deck. After that, Kodai Senga was lights out.
He was. And even pitches he was missing were super close.
Yeah.
He really did a fantastic job.
He's got people thinking he's going to throw the ghost pitch.
Yeah.
And then he throws the fastball by them, which I think is excellent because the Mets have guys that are trying to come back. They have, I don't think they're going to get much out of Montas, but he's trying to come back at some point. Sean Manaea, Blackburn, all these guys are trying to work their way back. The Mets staff, starting staff, has been unbelievable. Unfortunately, Paul Blackburn the other night got killed because it started raining.
Yeah.
Pitched 2 innings. And a weird play where the Mets thought they had a double play on a tag up, but you learn something new every night.
There were a lot of weird plays in that game.
A lot.
It was that had all the makings of like a Friday the 13th game, even though it wasn't. Last thing here before we finish up. So, Juan Soto, it's tough because, obviously, as both of us being Met fans and watching him last year on the Yankees, they're talking, he looks mopey, he doesn't look happy, different things. I mean, I'll certainly say he doesn't seem to have the juice in him right now, but it is still kind of early. But I think both of us were starting to buy into this a little bit, that some of this talk about his unhappiness and maybe it affecting his play and different things was beginning to filter into the team.
Yeah, I mean, to what extent do you think that really was? Do you think it was just kind of like him wishing he didn't make the decision to come to the Mets, or do you think it's just more like the grass might have been greener a little bit more last year?
Yeah, look, he's going to eventually at some point start being Juan Soto at the plate. He's going to get super hot. He's going to hit a ton of home runs. He's got seven steals already. He's getting on base. You know, he's playing an adequate outfield. He's never going to be, a superstar out there for his defense. But I think he's going to turn it around, and this will be a distant memory for a little while. But hey, if we get into the postseason and he starts to pull this stuff, then we're going to have some issues. But
I don't think it's a postseason issue. I think those lights come on, by that point, he'll be 162 games into the season. He's not taking days off either. No. When the Mets go to one of the places, I don't know if it's going to be L.A. or Colorado, he's going to get a day off. Mm-hmm. You know, I think
probably L.A. and Colorado, they're probably like, hey,
yeah, maybe
check swing home runs
maybe,
out of there.
Yeah. but one of those days he'll get a day off. Mendoza doesn't like to screw the fans out of not getting Soto on a day. So I think he'll get that time. But, I think he's going to be okay when it comes that far. I think the Mets right now are just struggling to figure out an everyday lineup.
Right.
Watching Mark Vientos tonight, it's like...
I've been saying I love Brett Beatty, man.
Yeah, I know. The good part about Brett is he's finally realizing that he's more versatile now, that he could play second base, third base. He can be a DH. He could play different positions and get himself in the lineup every night. And I think that's a good thing because he's swinging the bat well. And I'm going to say it every time we're on the air. At some point in the next few weeks, Ronnie Mauricio is going to come up and have a huge impact with the New York Mets. He's already hitting homers at AAA. So I think that's a place where someone's going to lose a spot. Could it mean Mauricio goes back down to AAA? I don't know. But he can play different spots, and I'm excited to see that.
There's one last thing I want to mention to you. I'm boycotting every Cubs game this year because I cannot watch Pete Crow Armstrong hit another huge home run for them after. And you Met fans, you know all about him. First round pick, got traded a few years ago. Having a great season. Anyway.
In the future, we could talk a little bit of Yankees. Yeah. They are having a pretty good season. What I just don't like, Mike, to finish up is just, and it doesn't have to be like on the internet or out loud. There's just so much of like the Yankees bashing the Mets and the Mets trying to go back and bash the Yankees. Yeah. I just don't need that stuff.
Nah.
Both teams are doing fine. Let it go and forget about the Juan Soto talk and all that stuff.
Absolutely. Big thanks to Scott Kiner, who came on and told us all about his book. You can find it on Amazon and also through the Baseball Hall of Fame. Great guest. Thanks to Brian Graves behind the glass. Always does a great job for us. Cap, we'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll see where things are at.
Yep.
And by that time, maybe we'll add a little French Open tennis.
All right. Sounds good.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.